Welcome to Monday's edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. Today, we are bridging the gap between past insights and future uncertainties. In the first half, we'll explore the intriguing concept of digital immortality with NDSU's Dr. Dennis Cooley, inspired by his recent contribution to an article in The Atlantic titled, No One is Ready for Digital Immortality. It's clear that both Dr. Cooley and I are still grappling with the implications of this potentially bizarre future. Later in the show, we'll turn our focus to the past as our great friend Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University shares his latest Plainsfolk essay. This one's titled Magic Healing. The essay highlights the remarkable story of Shirley Fisher Ahrens, a scholar of the Germans from Russia, whose seminal work, The Central Dakota Germans, beautifully captures the cultural legacy of North Dakota's prairie pioneers. Dr. Cooley, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you.
In my will, I have provisions for my wife, my kids, my car, my house, the workbench that my dad made, but I don't have any provisions in my will for my death bot. Am I making an error there? It didn't make the guest list.
Well, I'm not surprised because this is relatively new technology.
Tell us what a deathbot is.
A deathbot is what it's supposed to be. Let's go with that because they really don't exist as of yet. A deathbot is supposed to take all of the information you have, digital information that is on the internet and anywhere else we can scrape it, and put that together so that it can create something that would be able to respond to questions, give advice, and also even might have an image. So if you've never had a picture taken of yourself, these things cannot make up your picture because what happens with them, as I said, is they have to use all the data that are in existence now. It can't create new data.
For many of us, there really is a lot of data that is now online and available.
Well, for those, especially for those who use social media a lot, because what it looks for, and this is just the AI itself, AI scrapes enormous amounts of data across the internet all the time. So they can do things that human beings can't even imagine being done. Now, the more you have electronic data, the more accurate whatever the death bot will be, because that's it's basically training it to make it act and react in a certain way. So if I've never published anything, if I've never been online, all it would have a lot of data with numbers for my bank accounts and various things, my phone numbers and so on. But it wouldn't be able to create a death bot because there's not enough material there to be able to put together words, sentences, and so on. If you keep a diary, anybody reading the diary, by the end of reading your diary, which they shouldn't do, they shouldn't do it, but they would be able to say, I sort of understand this person. If I gave this person a question, I would be able to answer the question using how this person thinks. So the more you put online, the more information like that, the better the death pot is going to be at duplicating what you can do.
So I die. Somebody potentially could make a death bot of me, interact with me, ask me for advice, or do criminal things, God forbid. What ethical concerns are there with these things, and why should I be concerned about them today?
Well, I don't think you should actually be concerned about them today.
Really? Even though all my digital footprint is just hanging out there?
Well, it's your digital footprint, but it's not you. So what, one of my areas is, of course, death and dying. There's a difference between a person and a corpse. We don't set people on fire, at least we shouldn't be setting people on fire, but we cremate corpses. Nobody thinks much of that anymore. I'm not saying that I'm harming the person because the person died. Now, some people think that there's an afterlife, some people don't. It doesn't really matter how that goes. It does to those folks who really want to believe. But the corpse can't be harmed. You can't be harmed because you are not the corpse. Those are two different things. So when you die, what's left over are artifacts, but they're not you. in any significant sense, because the psychological person dies when the mind dies, or the psychological person separates from the brain when the body dies. Those are the two ways. Those could be harmed, but they're not present here. So your artifacts cannot possibly be you. Just the way that my shoes and my clothes and so on, those are all artifacts of me, but they're not me.
I remember walking through Salt Lake's airport not long after the Olympics were held there, and there was a hologram of Princess Leia, I believe from Star Wars, mm-hmm. there. It was somewhat rudimentary, but it was somewhat real. You could see the person. I can see people want to monetize this to allow a grieving spouse, maybe a grieving grandparent, to create this thing, pay for it, and live in this altered world where there's interaction with this death bot, which is such an odd word to me.
Right, it is. It's too much like a robot, but it does give an impression. But let me move this a little bit away from that question, then get back to it. Right now, if somebody took all of that information, your voice is on because it's been recorded, it would be able to duplicate your voice beautifully, the tones, all the rest of this.
Inflection, the whole thing.
Everything would be perfect. If they were doing that now, I would have an ethical concern about that in regards to you. Because you are alive. You could be harmed by what's going on in regards to that, what that says or how it does it. It could be using your voice to get into your bank accounts, to do all different things. So when you're alive, you can be harmed. And that bothers me, but that's not a death bot. It's more complicated for the ones after death. That new entity is not you. There's no personal identity over time. It's not you. What I worry about is the living, the survivors. So I also worry about this with there are really creepy things that are happening right now in regards to AI-generated boyfriends and girlfriends. They're very disturbing. Don't go online unless you really want to see some odd things. Some of it, the idea is it's replacing real people for folks who cannot find significant others. I find that very distressing because I think part of what it is to be human is to be a social animal. Part of that is being valued by other individuals. And so that's part of a good life, a flourishing life. The same sort of thing I'm worried about is with the death bots. So if you have a spouse who has died, the survivor, is the survivor going to be converting his or her life over to having a relationship? It's not a real relationship because there's nothing there. It's just a program.
I think in my mind of the scenario we've all seen in the movie or maybe read about where that one voicemail we hold on to and replay to hear our loved one.
Right.
Well, this is that on steroids, it seems to me. I can understand a market for it.
No, there will be a market. There's a market for a lot of things that we shouldn't be involved in. There's always a difference between what we can do versus what we should do. And I'm all right with creating these death bots.
Really?
Suppose you've got a person, an elderly individual, their spouse of 60 years just died. They don't get out much because they can't drive and so on. These individuals, I'm fine with them there being death bots for them because it keeps them occupied. It keeps their mind going. Now, if they have dementia, for example, that helps out. My dad had dementia. He kept thinking my grandparents were alive. We were told to say that no, they weren't able to come and so on. But I wonder how much comfort he would have had from a death bot. So I see that as a good thing. I see it as a good thing for folks who are alone in a house, the way that my mother is after my dad died, that she'd be able to talk to this death bot and have some response back and forth. But I'm showing you very limited value, but there really is value in this because it keeps people active. It keeps their minds going. It's a very positive thing. What I worry about is the same thing for the boyfriends and girlfriends. If you have an opportunity to have a relationship with a real person, you should do that. Why? Because that relationship creates a new entity, the we. And there's feedback that goes back and forth with that. Right now, we're talking to each other, we're reading each other and coming up with different things. The great thing about this is I don't know exactly what you're thinking, you don't know exactly what I'm thinking, although we're having a conversation that we understand. And there's amazing that that is happening, that somebody is really valuing you, that is not merely a program that doesn't value at all, it just interacts with you, it just reacts the way a plant would react if you took it out of the sun. But this is really, human interaction is essential to having a good life. Now, are there people who can't do that? Yeah, let's make it for that. Another ethical concern I have is how much this costs. It is very pricey.
For now.
It might be cheaper later on. But this also privileges certain individuals even more so. So they already have the privilege of having wealth. Earned or not, you know, that's a different conversation. But there are a lot of folks who already are vulnerable, who are at disadvantages, who aren't going to be able to get any of this benefit. Once we make it common in the United States, cell phones, for example, are common in the United States. They're not common in a lot of very poor countries. They don't get the benefit. They don't get to be able to compete with us because they don't have that technology. I'm not sure that this technology will ever get to the very poorest in the world as well. And again, that could be okay. Certain things are okay. Even I'm fine, by the way, with the United States crushing competition. I like the fact that the U.S. is able to do so many things, and I'm very grateful I was born in this country rather than any place else. But we can talk about needs. Do we actually need this technology? And the answer is, well, yes, for certain people that I've explained about. No, for a huge other number of people. You should be going out and actually interacting with more people. Why is that a good thing just in general? Because the more we focus on our technology, the more we become alienated from other individuals, the more strife our country will have, the more difficulty we'll have with relationships. I think part of the reason that people are so angry now and we have such issues right now is because we're no longer really recognizing that all of these other beings walking around are people with shared values, with shared emotions, with shared goals and so on. They're real people. What we're doing is we're focusing on our phones. I've seen people at dinners, at where they go to restaurants and so on, none of them talk to each other. They're just playing with this. These death bots pose that same sort of thing, even more removed. You're not even with any other living creature. You're with a computer program that can never change unless there's a flaw in the system. Because whatever the AI generates, it can only generate on what exists. It never has free will. It can never mature. It can never do any of these things unless it's programmed to maybe the image starts to age or something along those lines. But that's all fake. But we learn. We constantly learn as we go along. We constantly alter. The person you are now, I'm an old guy. I'm 59. I'm not the same person I was 20 some years ago. I'm not the same person I was when I was 10. Certainly not the same person I was when I was born, because my mother would not have been happy if I were 230 pounds, 6 feet tall. When I was born, that would not have been a pleasant experience for her. But psychologically, I'm a vastly different person. But you have to be able to grow. These things can't do that unless you put randomness in it.
I will say I'm now wondering what I'm going to look like when I'm 429 years old. Dr. Cooley, we're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Dennis Cooley. He's the department head of the School of Humanities and professor of philosophy and ethics at North Dakota State University. What should I think about Dr. Cooley now, while I'm alive, relative to my digital footprint's use after I die? Is there anything that I should think about today for later?
Well, I think it's the same sort of thing you should think about when you're alive. How are you interacting with people online? What sort of things are you saying and doing? Social media, for example, can be incredibly good about keeping people informed about different things, what their friends are doing and so on. It can also be really destructive because it puts this, again, distance between us interacting with real people. So you see some really hateful things going on, some things that are said that are just, I would say, un-American, unethical, and
mean.
Indecent. Well, not just mean, because mean is one thing. This is violent. This is vicious. Mm. This is not who we are. One thing I've noticed about the state of North Dakota, we talk about Minnesota Nice. North Dakota really is, you don't do this stuff. We are a community, and I hope that we keep this. I've been here 22 years and keep this. But what you need to do is make sure you're not putting that stuff out in the first place. If it's online, it's forever. You cannot possibly scrub all of these things from all of the different things that are collecting, especially these AI databases that are constantly scraping. They got it. It is now property of whoever owns the database, and they will not give that up. So be very careful with that. I'm not saying be a Mary Sunshine or anything along those lines, although that's, I know people are like that. That's wonderful. But with this, don't put stuff on that you don't want to live forever. Do that now. That will take care of the long term. But unfortunately, people share stuff and don't realize that once it's out, it's done forever. There's an old saying, once written, it's forever. Say it, forget it. Even saying it is being recorded. And we're being recorded constantly, or we're being monitored constantly. Most people don't realize when they have Siri or Alexa or anything. Those things are constantly monitoring you, listening for your voice. And we're told that it's not being recorded anywhere. But it's interesting how you are talking to your significant other about maybe buying onion rings, and suddenly on your feeds, you're starting to see ads about onion rings.
It's certainly part of our life today. Let's go back to this concept of death bots. Bend your mind, if you would, in the future, 5, 10, or 15 years. Are you concerned that, gosh, this has the potential to become more normal than we want to admit?
Oh, it will become more normal than we want to admit. There's nothing that's holding this back. There's no laws. They haven't even thought about anything to try to regulate this. And by the time they do, I have a friend who's on a committee with a U.S. senator. They're now starting to think about, well, should we say something about AI? That's gone. It's too late. You don't try to recover from something like this, because it is now...
The genie's out of the bottle.
And it's prevalent. There's no way of eliminating it. That's what's going to happen with these things as well. Just as all technology that becomes popular, it's usually held by the very wealthy at first, but then as it becomes more and more, as the technology develops, people, the skills become better, and the number of folks using it increase, then eventually the price goes down. And so that's what will happen with the death bots as well. The only folks who can really control that, as I said, are the ones who keep their online profile to a minimal. They don't let people record them, but you're always seeing people with their phones taking videos and things like that. So it will be, these things will be prevalent. Now, how they're used is always a matter. Technology, it's always about how it's used. It isn't really about the technology itself, unless you've got a death ray gun. That I have an objection to just off the bat. But any technology can be misused. Guns, for example, they can be misused, but they have their reason. I'm a hunter, by the way, and I shoot and so on. So, but I see people misusing them. The same thing will happen here.
Do you envision a world where people will start to plan how their death bot will be represented in whatever world it's represented in?
Yeah, because there is no person I know of who wants to die. Every person, even those who are at the end stage of their lives, want to matter. That is, they don't want 100 years from now for no one to even remember who they are. We have graveyards full of graves and unattended, because everybody who cared about that individual has died, and their children and their descendants have died off, and they're just sitting there. That scares the crap out of everybody, I would say, that you won't matter, that no one will remember you. So how do you get around that? How do you feel more positively about yourself? There will be people carefully curating this to create the death bot themselves so that it will exist. This is not going to be, there are some folks, by the way, this is creepy too, who are working on the transfer of consciousness from the human brain into a computer. That would have a form of immortality. Remember, this death bot is not actually you. It is the, we'll say the remnants of you, but it's not you. But they're going to, folks who can't, I'm not sure we're going to be able to transfer consciousness from where it actually thinks for itself. Although some of the things that I've been seeing coming out, the tech coming out, actually, I think that might happen, but not for a long time. But the death bots will be, that's what I would say in the next 2 to 3 years minimum. There will be organizations or there'll be companies that will be, you can live on forever with this and selling it as a way of
I can see
immortality.
The free plan. The bronze plan, the silver plan, and the gold plan. And here all of a sudden my kids and grandkids are going to start soaking money at something like this forever?
Yep. No, I think that that is likely to happen as long as there's profit to be made. And there will be profit because, as I said, there is absolutely no one who wants to die and not matter. This is a way of keeping yourself in existence. At least mentally, sure. You think, I'm in existence still. This I will matter. I will still be around to enjoy this. This will be along the lines of estates, by the way. So when you die, we have this legal fiction. Your estate comes into existence. It is you. These are your wishes. We will do these different things and so on. You have no more wishes, though, because you're dead. It's all over. But this estate becomes an entity on its own. These death bots will become their own entity, but they will be linked. And what I'm worried about is that people will be continue to sink money into the continuation of this, money that really should be going to their kids or to their others so that the money can go back and help those survivors out.
So I've made a decision and I've communicated that the best way that I possibly can, that the last thing I want is a death bot. I don't want that in my after future. But my spouse comes around and says, I'd like that after I'm gone. And here we go. Again, ethical considerations here. Do I have control of anything after I die?
Absolutely not. The only control you would have with this, and this is...
I can see a button that we all get to push right before we go that destroys our digital footprint.
Yeah, well, I don't think
I'm sure it's not going to be there.
Ahead, yeah, and we don't want to die, so we don't really do that. So what we can look at here is something a little bit comparable. When some people die, their images are copyrighted. So Einstein, Marilyn Monroe, those sorts of things. But they have to be very famous to have that happen, because you have to have a lawyer to protect it and so on. So that already sort of exists. Now, for most of us who don't have that fame and do not have that wealth that we can rely on, there's not much we can do. There's absolutely no law about taking those images and using them for your own purposes. Now, if you're alive, there's recourse to that, especially with some of these weird things that people are doing to create sexual things that with other people's faces. There's laws about that, but those people are in existence. They can be harmed. This one won't be, because you can't be harmed by this, and you're not going to be able to pull it off. And the thing with it is, again, you really won't care, because you are either in a better place, hopefully not in a worse place, or you don't exist at all. And so this will not be for you, this won't come into anything that happens to you. But my concern would be about the wife. Why is she doing it? Is she using the technology in a way that helps her be a better person, to help her to grieve, which is fine. Different people will grieve in different ways. I know of individuals who keep cards, for example, any card, and then they read those over. And how are they, that's sort of a connection.
The voicemail example I gave earlier.
Yep. The voicemail example that you have, where you can actually hear the person's voice, those are actually healthy. Because what's unhealthy is where we just sort of, the person's dead, we just write it off and move on and don't worry about that at all. A real relationship is like losing part of our body.
Coming after the break, more of our conversation with Dr. Dennis Cooley from North Dakota State University. What do his students think about death bots? That's after this news. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We resume our fascinating conversation with Dr. Dennis Cooley, Department Head of the School of Humanities and a Professor of Philosophy and Ethics at North Dakota State University. Additionally, Dr. Cooley is the Director of the Northern Plains Ethics Institute and the editor of Springer's International Library of Bioethics. Dr. Cooley recently contributed to an article in The Atlantic titled, No One is Ready for Digital Immortality.
You and I are likely closer to maybe being concerned about this than your students are. What are your students thinking about this idea of eternal representation by a death bot?
See, I think their view of technology is so vastly different from ours that even the most intimate things, they're not really worried about having posted online while they're alive, because they do all sorts of things. Now, when I was a kid, I couldn't have imagined having phones, but I also couldn't have imagined taking pictures of yourself in the nude and sending it to somebody else. It boggles my mind that people do this or say certain things to each other, because that's not what you do. But a lot of students do that. They think that's perfect. They share constantly. You look on YouTube, you have people who want viewer views about everything they do in their life. So there's no real privacy there whatsoever. They don't consider privacy the way we do, where privacy is an essential component to being a person, because even if you're not thinking anything wrong or anything bad or anything along those lines, you just don't want people in your business. You want to be left alone. That's much different from what we've got now, because they are sharing everything. They're constantly online. They're constantly engaged with that sort of thing. They're not engaged with real people. They're engaged through the phones. They're texting each other. They're doing all these different things. So I don't think they really will have much problem with this at all. Besides the fact that most people in their 20s, 18, who are 18, 20, don't really think about their death at all. It's an unreal sort of thing. I don't think people are my age or think about our death. I think when you're getting closer to it and you're saying, okay, I'm 83, my body's failing me, then you're looking for something along the lines of meaning. But that would be along the lines, well, as I said, we're of an older generation. These folks want to continue to exist because they're afraid of not existing. But these other ones coming in, all you have to do is say, you will always exist. You've posted a million times. You've texted a billion times. This is eternal.
You get to be the king of death bots, Dr. Cooley.
Okay.
As we wrap up our conversation today, what advice are you going to give yourself, being in control of how death bots will exponentially, I'm guessing, come into our world and into our lives or the lives of those we leave behind?
Oh, that's a lot of power. With any new technological development, the hard thing is to figure out what you need to do prior to it actually being introduced, and then you see what the real problems turn out to be. So many years ago, and I still write a little bit on transgenic organisms, GMOs, and I predicted certain things would happen. They didn't happen. Some of the things I predicted would happen, and then other things took us completely by surprise. The linkage of Roundup to cancer, the glyphosate, or Roundup Ready crops to cancer. This one is, if I were doing this, it would be a go slow approach, as always. You see what's happening as we go. But I would involve the end users a lot more. So the people, who are the people who are really interested in this? Survey them, find out what actually do they need. Do they need this technology that's going to cost money to develop and so on? Or do they need something else? How do you use it? Find out your end users and then design the technology to actually work. If it's not going to work to make their lives better, then don't do it.
I'm worried our survivors are going to be held hostage. That if you don't pay me, this is how we're going to represent Dad. But if you do pay me, this is how we're going to represent Dad. Do you fear for that?
Oh, I fear for that now. Because some of these deep fakes are so good right now, they're making people say things that they never have said, would say in their life. It was at the beginning of this with the AI and the generations and so on, it was easy to see what was wrong and so on. It's really hard now. And the voices, this is because we're more of a visual entity. I don't know if you know this, but if there's a battle between what you're hearing and what you're seeing, your sight always wins, because it's called the McGurk effect. And so your ears are not as sharp as your eyes are. And it's easier to fool them, to trick them. And that's what I'm worried about, that you will have people saying things and doing, this is a recorded conversation, so, where you can't trust anything anymore. And so that message that you think was a very positive message that your mother or father or whoever left you might actually be the fake. And the one where they're calling you a name or saying you're an idiot for doing this, that might be the real one, but you won't be able to tell the difference between it. Now, why does that really matter to me? Because I think the authentic one is the one that matters more. That's the real one. That's the one you have the relationship with. And the more we get away from that authenticity, those relationships we have with real people, the worse it's going to be for us, because it goes against our nature as social animals. It makes us unable to interact with others. And that's one of the problems we're having, where people think more of their individual, their isolated atomistic self, than they think of themselves as part of a community interacting. So yeah, I'm really worried about the voices and what it can be done, what can be done with it. I'm wondering when we're going to get living wills where they videotape some of the wills, where it's completely deepfake. And somebody comes in and says, this is, and I can show you that this person interacted with me and all of these different things.
This is what Dad said.
Yep, and will not be able to tell the difference between it. And again, that will favor, first of all, the evil who do it, and those with money who mm-hmm. can do that as well.
Brings a little different meaning to me of the term life goes on.
Well, yeah, I don't know how to improve on that. No, because, well, it's not a real life. But what happens is we can't let go. And that's a concern. Death is a real thing. And when you first sent me the really good questions and the things you've been thinking about, just that's a book level discussion. But what I was worried about is, how is this going to alter the living's views of their lives? If you can't die, or if people are not dying, then are they going to, instead of living their lives fully, now, while their psychological minds are going, while their physical bodies are here, are they going to be putting all of their effort into this entity that's not them, that will exist after they die as their monument? Is this going to be a monument that's in a cemetery, like many of the cemeteries, which is just left there, while the person never had a life? And I think that's a tragedy, because the best lives are lived in the moment with real people, and you have positive relationships that are nurturing. That's it. You should be focusing your attention on that, because you only have a certain amount of time and it's over. And these death bots are not you. Stop putting your time and effort into them. Be here now, be present, and have a great life.
Dr. Dennis Cooley, he's the department head of the School of Humanities and professor of philosophy and ethics at North Dakota State University. Wonderful conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me with me.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
Dr. Tom Ezern from North Dakota State University shares his latest plainspoke essay, Magic Healing. This essay highlights the remarkable story of Shirley Fisher Ahrens, a scholar of the Germans from Russia, whose seminal work, The Central Dakota Germans, beautifully captures the cultural legacy of North Dakota's prairie pioneers.
When I went to Kent State in 1961, recalls Shirley Fisher Ahrens, a great scholar of the history, language, and culture of the Germans from Russia, I had no idea that I was part of any kind of a unique cultural people. I thought I was simply an American. I came back to North Dakota and started to interview people, the pioneers who came from Russia to Dakota. All these people were so delighted and so thrilled that somebody cared. A young woman in the 1950s, Miss Fisher's ambitions were modestly aspirational. She got teacher training at Ellendale and Minot, and then taught for a year in Montana. Then off to Kent for the Master's in German Literature, writing a thesis about the language and culture of the folks back home in Ashley, North Dakota. After that, about 20 years living abroad before landing at Georgetown University, where she picked up her previous line of research for a dissertation, which eventually became a landmark work published in 1989 by Georgetown University Press, The Central Dakota Germans, Their History, Language, and Culture. A mentor had advised her at midlife to pursue the PhD in order to get scholarly guidance and elevate her work. This doesn't always happen in a graduate program, but in this case it did. And reflecting on that, Ahrens provides some astonishing disclosures and reflections. Of her dissertation experience, she says, "Magic healing is what the Germans call it. It's the healing that we found in the communities. In North Dakota, we call it Brauche. Brauche, the traditional practice of folk healing, come to the prairies with the people from Russia." Ahrens actually is comparing the process of writing her dissertation to the healing arts of the folk physicians back home and their communities. She reveals, in fact, that her grandmother was a Brauche. Crippled late in life by arthritis, but people still streamed to her house. "All of the old people of Ashley came to our home to visit her," says Ahrens. "So as a child, I had this enormous cultural knowledge." Her mother, too, was a Brauche, who, when her daughter came home for research, took her around to reintroduce her to people. I'm writing and speaking here from a remarkable interview recorded with Ahrens in 1997 by the writer Ron Vossler, himself a McIntosh County boy. You can go online to listen and read a transcript provided by the Germans from Russia Heritage Center at NDSU. I'm writing and speaking, too, from a recent rereading of Ahrens' book, The Central Dakota Germans. It's well worth your time to sit with this work, wrestle with the disciplinary trappings of the linguist, continue through to the chapters where the author warms to her subject, the speech, the customs, the life ways of her ancestral people. "The language holds the culture," she says. "Culture informs community, and community was the stuff of survival on the prairies. I think that in North Dakota we have a real sense of community, and I don't think you could have settled this vast plain without a real sense of community." So says Shirley Fisher Ahrens, and we should listen to her for magic healing.
That was our longtime friend, Dr. Tom Ezern. Dr. Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and regularly contributes his Plains Folk essays here on Main Street.
Hey, I'm Elsa Chang from NPR. I host All Things Considered, and so I'm tuned into the news all the time because I'm dedicated to making sure that you understand what's going on in the world during your commute home. I interview public officials, other leaders in our federal government all the time. That's an important part of what I do. But talking to artists, writers, other creatives, and, you know, the everyday people who are at the center of stories that we're reporting on, that is what I really care about. And I hope what comes out of your speakers or into your earbuds brings you some joy, that someone's story can add a little brightness to your day.
I've been asking you a series of questions to get you to brag about this heroic role that you have played in the history of this community in Asian American activism, and I feel your humility.
I did get picked to toss the ball at the A's game.
Nice!
For Asian Heritage Month.
The stories that we bring to you on NPR are made possible by our member stations and their supporters. I hope that you will become a sustaining member of Prairie Public right now. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the link that says donate. And thank you.
Main Street continues on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. We share now poetry from Studio 47 with its host, Patrick Hicks, who delves into the life and works of William Wordsworth, a pivotal figure in the Romantic movement whose deep connection to the Lake District profoundly influenced his poetic voice and legacy.
Mm-hmm. This is Poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is William Wordsworth. He was born on April 7th, 1770, in Cumberland, England. He was the second of five kids and grew up in an idyllic part of the country known as the Lake District. This would have a profound effect on him and, by extension, English literature. His father was away on business often, and this meant young William didn't know him very well. When Wordsworth's mother died in 1778, his father sent him away to Hawkshead Grammar School. Wordsworth didn't see much of his siblings after this and committed himself to schooling. When he graduated from Hawkshead, he was accepted into St. John's College at the University of Cambridge. He received his BA in 1791. Immediately after graduation, he went to revolutionary France, where he admired those who challenged the king. While there, he fell in love with Annette Vallon. They had a daughter in 1792. Wordsworth, however, was forced to return to England due to the worsening relationship between Britain and France. As the revolution turned more bloody, and as the guillotine claimed ever more lives, Wordsworth turned away from his early admiration. It also meant he couldn't return to France. When things finally quieted down, Wordsworth did return in 1802. By then, his daughter was 10 and estranged from him. He offered financial help for the rest of his life, but the relationship was over between he and Annette Vallon. He later remarried an English woman named Mary Hutchinson and would be with her until his death. Wordsworth became good friends with fellow poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Between them, they would create a new movement in English literature called Romanticism. Importantly, the Romantics were not interested in love or romance. They were interested in how England and the British Empire was similar to the Romans, hence the Romantics. They also cared about the countryside, and their poems often dealt with nature. This is hardly surprising when we consider that the Industrial Revolution was happening, and places like the Lake District were under threat of pollution. Wordsworth and Coleridge would write poems in everyday language, poems that could be understood by almost anyone, and they wrote for a wide audience. His books include Lyrical Ballads, Poems in Two Volumes, The Excursion, and The Prelude. Wordsworth became a celebrated poet throughout the United Kingdom, and, in fact, he became the Poet Laureate in 1843. As he aged, however, he wrote less and less. This became even more true when one of his daughters died quite suddenly, and he fell into depression. His work, especially his early work, transformed English literature due to not only its subject matter and the voice he employed, but also for its sheer readability. He died on April 23, 1850, in Grasmere. Today's poem is Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, September 3, 1802. My favorite city is, without question, London. There's something about the pulse of the place, the history, the buildings, the parks, the energy of the streets. It all captivates me. I miss it when I'm not there. In fact, if someone told me to choose a city I could never leave, I'd choose London every time. I am, quite simply, in love with the place, and whenever I return, it's like going home. I think many writers feel this way, and if you're British, it's virtually impossible not to be influenced by London. The same is true for you, too, of course. I mean, after all, the words coming out of my mouth are in English. These are the words of a faraway city, a city that was once the capital of a global empire. Although we don't think about it this way, it's true that London was once the capital of our country. This is why we rebelled, of course, in 1776. Colonial America no longer wanted London to be our capital. So, for good or bad, this English city has directly influenced world history for many centuries. I've written about all of this in one of my books called This London. As for Wordsworth, although his first love was the Lake District in northern England, and although much of his poetry deals with nature, his fortunes were tied to the metropolis of London. For those in the 1800s, London was sometimes called the Big Smoke due to all of the pollution. I mean, just imagine all the coal smoke that filled the air at the time. That euphemism, London fog, is something that you might have heard about. But that fog? That's not fog. That's banks of coal smoke that people had to walk through. For Wordsworth, a man who loved hikes and nature, he must have found the pollution of London to be an ordeal. Which brings us to our poem for the day. Here, Wordsworth is on Westminster Bridge. That's the one immediately in front of Big Ben. I'm sure you've seen it. And he's looking out at the city. It's dawn, everything is quiet, and the mighty engine of this empire city is still. But he knows that London will soon awaken, and he marvels at the sleeping energy which will soon rise. This is Composed Upon Westminster Bridge, September 3rd, 1802, by William Wordsworth. Earth has not anything to show more fair. Dull would he be of soul who could pass by a sight so touching in its majesty. This city now doth, like a garment, wear the beauty of the morning, silent, bare, ships, towers, domes, theaters, and temples lie open unto the fields and to the sky, all bright and glittering in the smokeless air. Never did sun more beautifully steep in his first splendor valley, rock, or hill. Ne'er saw I, never felt, a calm so deep. The river glideth at his own sweet will. Dear God, the very houses seem asleep, and all that mighty heart is lying still.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded remotely due to the coronavirus pandemic and produced by Peter Folliard. We both send our best wishes. Thank you for listening.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 7 is about Native identity. It states, individual and communal identity is defined and supported by shared Native languages, kinship systems, Teoshpae, clan structures, traditional teachings, values, sacred laws, and ceremonies. A continuum of tribal identity, unique to each individual, ranges from assimilated to traditional lifestyle. There is no generic American Indian.
In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll be listening to Oliver Gord, enrolled member of Spirit Lake Nation, talking about two types of education.
There's a Washichu, you know, then there's the Indian. Mm-hmm. I grew up both ways bilingually all my life. And I too went to California and I graduated with my Mimas here in Manoc, boarding school during the week. You know, to California, Cal State had 26,000 students, and my major was business administration and marketing. Now I'm teaching Dakota language, so it's just the opposite, you know. I was telling one of these people one time, this guy had this doctorate degree, and I said, you know, there's two educations. I said, there's Washichu, and that's good. We need that in today's world. But there's a Dakota way too. You know, the language. So you know the language, that's good. And then, you know, if you go to ceremonies, sweats, and if you're a sun dancer, if you're a pipe carrier, if you're a healer, if you're a singer, if you know the medicines, the herbs, all that kind of stuff, history. I said, if you went to that university, I said, and told him what you know, he said, you'd be the only one that knows what you know at that university. And then the Washichu world, when somebody knows something up here, dude, they give them all kinds of initials behind their name. I said, you go tell them. I said, maybe they'll give you a voice behind yours.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Judith Orloff is a board-certified psychiatrist
and a member of the UCLA Psychiatric Clinical Staff. She has written her newest book, The Genius of Empathy, and she will be our guest. And we hope you'll also be our guest tomorrow, right here on Main Street.